Good evening. This is Steve Santaciro, your state senator here in the 10th District in Bucks County, and welcome to our telephone town hall. Tonight, the focus of our discussion is COVID-19. Unfortunately, we are still talking about COVID-19. We would have hoped a few months ago that we would be on to different topics, but the Delta variant, which has emerged across the United States as well as other parts of the world, has caused us to continue to put focus on the pandemic. So tonight we're going to be talking about the Delta variant. We're going to be talking about the vaccine program, boosters, masking, and any other related question that you might have. We're very fortunate this evening to be joined by a very distinguished panel to help us sort through these issues. But before I introduce the panel, I want to say a few words about two of the organizations that they represent. The first is the Pennsylvania Biotech Center located in Buckingham Township near Doylestown. Not many of us in Bucks County realize how fortunate we are to have that organization in our midst. It is a leader in biotechnology breakthroughs, and it is, I believe, can be the impetus to a new biotech corridor in our part of Pennsylvania that can be a real catalyst for our economy for many decades to come. We also are represented tonight by the Doylestown Health Organization and Doylestown Hospital, of course, which has done really yeoman's work in the course of this pandemic over the last 19 or 20 months or so in treating our fellow residents who have contracted COVID and really have been heroes and throughout this process. So we're very proud of both of those institutions, and I'm grateful that they are represented on our panel here tonight. So with that, let me introduce our panel. Our first guest is Dr. Tim Block, who is the president and founder of the Pennsylvania Biotechnology Center that I just described. Dr. Block is also the president and co-founder, along with his wife Joan, of the Hepatitis B Foundation and the Baruch S. Bloomberg Institute. Next July, Dr. Block will become executive chair of the Hepatitis B Foundation's board of directors and will begin a sabbatical to continue his research and teach at Yale University. We're also joined tonight by Dr. Shari Cohen. Dr. Cohen is the Senior Vice President of the Hepatitis B Foundation, and next July will be stepping into Dr. Block's role as President of the Hepatitis B Foundation, which is on the campus of the Biotech Center. For the last 20 years, Dr. Cohen has been a public health researcher, policy expert, and advocate. Next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Randall Heyer. Dr. Heyer is Senior Vice President for Global Medical Affairs at Moderna. Dr. Heyer also serves as Adjunct Distinguished Professor in Experimental Therapeutics at the Baruch S. Bloomberg Institute and Senior Advisor to the Hepatitis B Foundation. Dr. Heyer has over 15 years' experience in biotechnology with vaccines, biologics, and biosimilars. In his position at Moderna, Dr. Heyer helped develop, communicate, and manage the global rollout of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccine. In 2017, he played a pivotal role in engaging the scientific, medical, and policy communities to achieve approval of a new adult hepatitis B vaccine. My final guest this evening is Jim Brexler, President and CEO of Doylestown Health. I'm grateful that Jim has made himself available tonight to focus on the ongoing role of our hospitals in this pandemic and the work that they have done and obviously will continue to do until we get through this crisis. So with that, we're happy to open the lines to any questions you have. I have a few initially that we received ahead of time. So we will start with those. The first one is, what are the differences technically and effectively between the Moderna, Pfizer, and J&J vaccines? Dr. Heyer, do you want to try to answer that question?
Sure, definitely, Senator Santaciro. Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody, for your interest and help in combating, working together in fighting COVID-19. I'm convinced that together we will defeat it. The question technically is the differences between the three vaccines, the J&J vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, and the Moderna vaccine. So at the high level, the J&J vaccine is different than the Pfizer vaccine based on the technology. So the J&J vaccine is an adenovirus vector vaccine. It carries the ability to make the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. That's the protein that we induce the immune response against to protect us from COVID-19. That's carried in the adenovirus vector. With the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine use a newer technology based on mRNA or messenger RNA, which uses a basic biology for the body's immune system to produce the spike protein and form an immune response in a natural fashion. Going further, the J&J vaccine, of course, was approved as a single-dose vaccine. The Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are both two-dose vaccines administered over approximately 1 month. Going between the two, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine use the same basic technology, the messenger RNA technology, though they differ considerably in how they are put together. Most noticeably on the outside is the dose is different. The Pfizer vaccine is a 30 microgram dose. The Moderna vaccine is a 100 microgram dose. The performance of the vaccine in the initial clinical studies was astonishingly close, which I think is just an interesting fact that in two different clinical studies with tens of thousands of participants done in a randomized, blinded fashion, using different manufacturers, many different parts, the point efficacy estimate, that is the performance of the vaccine in the clinical studies, was within 1% of each other, 94% for one and 95% for the other, which I just think is astonishing and is reinforcing in the validity of this new technology to prevent COVID-19. And, of course, we've seen that as the vaccines have gone into use.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And let me right here remind our callers that if you want to ask a question live on the line, please press *3. That's *3 on your phone keypad, and you will be connected with us live here tonight, and we'll be happy to answer your questions. Thank you very much for that, Dr. Heyer. And of course, the J&J vaccine, as you said, was approved for a single dose. But that was that primarily a function of the way that Johnson & Johnson decided to study the effectiveness of it? I mean, it could be that a booster is in the future for J&J as well. Is that correct?
That could very well be. The data that they presented for emergency use authorization was based on a single dose. They have subsequently conducted studies that have been reported publicly about a second dose of their vaccine, which does increase the point efficacy estimate. But whether it stays as a single dose or a second or two dose vaccine is I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, great. We're going to go to the lines now, and bear with us for just a minute. I think the first person we have on the line is Sydney from Doylestown.
Yes.
Sydney, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Thank you for being with us this evening. What's your question?
My question is, will the Moderna have a follow-up shot?
Will the Moderna have a follow-up shot? Well, Dr. Heyer, I think you're the right person to go to.
Sure. Yeah. So, of course, we have done studies on a follow-up or a booster shot with the Moderna vaccine. We have submitted those data to the regulatory authorities, and we're waiting for their decision. So it'll be up to the FDA to make that booster shot authorized and to the CDC to recommend it. So those two steps, of course, we don't control. I just have seen the data, and of course, the data look very good for a follow-up or a booster shot from the Moderna vaccine, but the decision to authorize and recommend is not ours.
Okay. Thank you. And is that likely to be the same dosage if it is ultimately approved?
That'll also be up to the regulatory authorities and the recommending authorities. We have studied it at the full dose and the half dose, and we have made those data available.
Great. Thank you. Next, we have Terry from Yardley. Oh, I'm sorry. Becky from Lower Makefield. You're next. Becky, you're on the line?
Hi. Yes, I am. Here's my question. I had the Pfizer vaccine. It's been 6 months and a week since I had my second shot. I've read varying accounts of have it right away or wait 7 to 8 months. I'm wondering what your panel thinks about the best time for getting the shot. I'm someone who I don't have any other health issues. I'm just 68.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Becky. Dr. Cohen, do you want to handle that question?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. That's a great question. I just want to really quickly define the difference between a third dose and a booster dose. So a third dose of vaccine is currently recommended for some people who are severely immune compromised and who might not have built up sufficient immunity after the first two doses. So though in those folks, a third dose is often recommended 28 days after the second. So it sounds like you don't fall into this category, but the third dose is different than the booster dose, which is what you're talking about. And the booster dose is essentially what would confer longer term immunity. The recommendation that came out, and remember, booster doses have only currently been recommended for Pfizer, but the recommendation does hold for 6 months. So, you know, if you look at the language, it does leave it up to people to decide, you know, whether they fall into any of those risk categories that would increase their exposure or would increase their likelihood of having severe disease. But it doesn't say 7 months, it doesn't say 8 months. The recommendation does say 6 months after your second dose.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Does anyone else on our panel want to add anything to that?
Yeah, this Dr. Heyer, I'd just like to add that I understand the question, Becky, and it's a really good one. And I want to emphasize that the SARS, the disease COVID-19, and our understanding of the virus that causes it, SARS-CoV-2, is all new, right? This disease only emerged in late December 2019. So we're still evaluating data as we're going. The classic immunization against a new pathogen that you or me haven't seen before is generally over a period of time of 6 months, and in many cases is a three-dose regimen, some cases two-dose regimen with other vaccines against a similar style of disease. That doesn't necessarily mean that'll be the same case for COVID-19, but it's important reference data to consider as we look forward. So, and generally those regimens are over a 6 month period because the initial dosing is the priming, and there's a period of time to allow the immune system to mature and adapt its response, and then to boost it with the dose that occurs at the 6 month window. And that, as Dr. Cohen said, has been in other diseases for sure, has shown to give people long-term immunity.
Great. Thank you very much. So again, *3 on your phone keypad, *3 on your phone keypad to be connected live with us tonight to ask a question of our distinguished panel. Next, we have Terry in Yardley. Terry, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Senator, I'm your biggest fan, but I want to ask, this is an important question. First of all, my husband was already given the third dose of Moderna. It was probably 4 to 5 months after his second dose because he's got, health issues, and they called him to get it. Now, I didn't even know it was available, because in most pharmacies, they tell you they don't have it yet. But he did get Moderna the first two, and he got it the third already. No reaction, no anything. I got Pfizer. I got called to come in early for the third one. And I had the most awful reaction. I ran 103 temperature, which is high for 70. Yeah, I'm going to be 70 years old, but I have a horrible immune system. I ran this temperature for just slightly over a week. I couldn't move, couldn't get out of bed, couldn't eat, couldn't do anything. And my own doctor would not let me come into the office. They just told me if it goes any higher, go to the ER. If I should have been tested, I wasn't, so that's on me. But I'm wondering, could that have been COVID? Or is that, it's not a typical reaction because I didn't have it to the first two. But it was just unbelievable. And does it matter, now that I'm listening to you, does it matter that my husband and I got it early? And also, I'll add one other thing, if you don't mind. My entire family are all totally vaccinated, and my granddaughter, who's 11 and a half, is now at home with COVID. And I would like to know what they can do and how quickly they can push to get these kids vaccinated before they go to school and are around other kids.
Okay. Well, a lot to unpack there, Terry. Thank you for your questions. I'm going to take the first part of your question regarding what happened to you, and I'm going to direct that to Dr. Cohen. And then the second part with respect to vaccinating younger children, I'm going to direct to Dr. Heyer. Dr. Cohen?
Sure. Thank you. That's a great question. So a lot of this is a little bit new territory for us. So it is certainly possible that your reaction was from the vaccine, and it's certainly possible that your reaction was from COVID. I think the hard part is not knowing. And I know you wish you had a test. It sounds like you just weren't able to go and get one, and I'm sorry that you had that reaction to it. You could consider going to get your antibody level tested, too. That might help give you a little bit of peace of mind in terms of your current protection. I think your experience, as we're moving through the process of giving out third doses in our country and in other countries, we are collecting lots and lots of data. And at some point, there will be enough data to help you kind of figure out what may have happened in your case. But right now, it's really hard to say.
Great. Thank you. And Dr. Heyer, can you chime in with respect to the cohort of younger children?
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you. And Terry, I can appreciate the questions you have. And I think it's important that we do immunize younger children because I believe the modeling data to date that looks at control of COVID-19 is going to require a substantial immunity in the youngest part of our population. They don't necessarily, they obviously get generally a milder disease, but not always. Some children get very, very sick from COVID-19. So it's going to be important to immunize them. Of course, there are vaccines already authorized for use in younger children. We have conducted clinical studies in younger children and submitted those data to the FDA and awaiting, for their review. And we're continuing our efforts to generate data on even younger populations at even lower doses to make these tools available to public health officials to help control COVID-19.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that, Dr. Heyer. Again, star three on your phone to be connected live with us tonight to ask our distinguished panel questions that you might have regarding the pandemic, whether it's about vaccines, boosters, masking, or any other related issue regarding COVID-19. Next, we have Marcia in Chalfont. Marcia, you're live.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I received two Moderna vaccine injections. My last one was March of this year. At this point of the year, am I eligible to get the third injection? I am a senior. I'm way over 70 years old, and I'd like to know if I'm if I'm eligible to get my third vaccine.
Thanks, Marcia. Well, as we discussed a few moments ago, Moderna has submitted the data to the FDA for approval of a third dose or a booster, as Dr. Cohen distinguished before. But that has not yet happened. So hopefully it will happen in the not-too-distant future. Dr. Heyer, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I just we're hoping that the decisions will be made soon to help people like you get the care they need. So that's as much as I can add. Yes, we have submitted the data.
Thank you for that. Next, star 3 is the way you connect with us live tonight to ask a question. Our next caller is Dolores from Yardley. Dolores, you're on the line. Okay. Doesn't sound like Dolores.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Dolores?
Yes?
Yeah, hi. You're live on the line with us this evening. Good evening.
Okay. What I would like to know is they tell us to get our flu shot, and then I had the Pfizer shot, and I'm 70 years old. How much time between those two shots do we wait?
Okay. Dr. Cohen, do you want to answer that question?
Sure. You can get them at the same time. You don't have to wait.
You don't have to wait. There's no...
No, there's no waiting time. So you can even make an appointment now. For those who are eligible for that booster dose, you can make an appointment and get them at the same time. So I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to know.
All right, Doris. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Take care. Again, star 3 is the way you connect live with us this evening. Star 3 on your phone keypad, and you can ask a question of our distinguished panel. Next, we have Karen from Doylestown. Karen, are you on the line?
Hear me?
I can now, Karen, yes.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had my shot Pfizer in the middle of March. It's now like 6.5 months. I'm going to be getting the flu shot, and you just answered my one question because I heard it was 2 months from the flu shot to the booster, but you just said that was false. Okay, but do you think that the booster will be ready by the middle of November? And if it's not ready for the general public, will my percentage go to zero after 9 months of being immunized? And I'll
Dr.
be able to get COVID
Heyer,
fast?
Dr. Heyer, do you want
yeah.
to take a crack at that?
I certainly will. I mean, the ultimate is we don't know the data to answer that question based on data. We do know that two doses of the mRNA vaccines in particular have produced durable immunity, particularly against severe outcomes such as hospitalization, ICU admission, things of that nature for COVID-19. And those data, at least in the data set from Moderna and for the Pfizer, are very durable out to at least 6 months after the primary series. I suspect it will go longer. I just don't, you know, we don't have data that I can look at longer than that right now. So the data would suggest that the window that you're describing wouldn't be particularly different than the data that we have. Obviously, we're doing everything we can now to try to make these doses available to address the need. So that's the strongest statement I can make. Other than it's very important that everybody gets their flu shot, because influenza is also still a major hazard, particularly for older people. And the flu shot is our most effective weapon against influenza.
Thank you for that, Dr. Heyer. Before we go back to the phones, and again, it's star 3 on your phone keypad to be connected live with us tonight, I want to direct one of our questions that we received prior to the call tonight to Mr. Brexler of Doylestown Health. And it's a question about current capacity at our hospitals, given the increase in cases as a result of the Delta variant. Could you speak to that?
Yes, Senator, I'd be glad to. So we monitor our hospital capacity on a weekly basis and actually daily report into the state all of the capacity in every hospital in Pennsylvania, and particularly here in Bucks County. And fortunately, we've got we're holding our own basically in terms of capacity. We've had this is a busy season for not just COVID, but for other kinds of illnesses that are playing themselves out. But because we have early testing and able to sort of manage cases very differently than we did in the first two waves, we've been able to really manage through this and continue to be available for people that have other medical issues. So right now, our capacity is reasonably good. Our pediatric capacity in Bucks County, we can in the emergency rooms and in ours, and there's just a couple of pediatric units, but no critical care pediatric capacity. That's a little bit different scenario. The children's hospitals in Philadelphia, where we would generally refer high-risk children to be hospitalized, they have been running very close to full capacity, not just with COVID, although they have had COVID admissions, but there has been a tremendous spike in other kinds of viral disease that's playing itself out. RSV has hit our community, respiratory illnesses. And so those hospitals are running pretty full these days, although they can manage their capacity a little bit by adjusting the amount of elective work they might do at any given point in time. But right now we're sort of holding our own, but cautious and watching carefully the increase in community prevalence. And unfortunately, Bucks County is seeing an increase month over month of COVID cases being detected through the testing centers.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Brexler. And that's an excellent time for me, and a segue for me to remind everyone that it's critically important that you get vaccinated. If you have not yet been vaccinated, you've heard so far this evening from our panel how effective these vaccines are. Please, please, please get vaccinated and, you know, continue to wear masks, especially when indoors, if you're, you know, potentially could be exposed to people who have not been vaccinated. But even if, you know, you're asymptomatic, you could still spread the disease even if you have been. So it's important that we are careful about that so that our hospitals don't get overwhelmed. Again, star three on your phone keypad, and you'll be connected live with us tonight. Next, we have Joe from Doylestown. Joe, you're live.
Yes, Joe from Doylestown. Mine is not so much a question as an observation. I'm old enough to remember the polio scare back in the 50s when Sabin and who's the other one? Salk, Jonas Salk came out with their vaccines. Mothers just flocked with their children to get their children inoculated. There were no questions about is there ethics that bode against this. There were no religious proscriptions. There was nothing. It just seemed like science said that this was the way to counteract this vicious disease that was affecting so many young people. And lo and behold, polio has been consigned to the dustbin of history now. So what's going on now? Why don't people respect what science has to offer? Why don't people? I don't get it. Anyway, that's not really a question as much as an observation. There, I've said my piece.
Okay, Joe. Well, thank you very much for that. And I think everyone on this line tonight would agree. You know, candidly, there's a lot of misinformation that has gotten out in to the public, whether it's through the internet, whether it's on cable news shows. There are a variety of different outlets in which that's happened, and it's unfortunate, obviously, because this is a public health crisis, and we really ought to be guided by the science and nothing more. But that has not happened in this particular case, and it is the frustration because still not enough people in this country are vaccinated, and it's not an issue of supply. There are plenty of doses of vaccine available. So, you know, Joe, all I would say to you is, you know, you need to be an ambassador along with the rest of us to get the word out that people need to get vaccinated if they haven't been. Again, *3 on the your phone keypad to be connected live with us tonight to ask a question of our panel. Next, I have Kathy from Bristol. Kathy, you're live on the line.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to know, my sister will not get the vaccine because a friend of hers from Thailand sent her information that eventually the elderly are going to end up with early Alzheimer's because of the makeup of the vaccine. And after she told me that, I had gotten both of my shots, and I'm concerned about what she told me.
Okay. Let me turn to Dr. Heyer first to respond to that. Dr. Heyer?
Sure. There's no data that suggests at all that that would occur. So I'm not sure where the information came from, but we have no data, no information, no suggestion at all that that would occur. And so I think we can be confident in the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine. I would like to add that when history is written, the scrutiny and the close observation for safety events in these vaccines will have occurred at a level that has never happened before. In other words, the number of eyes and different studies and agencies and organizations observing safety of these vaccines is unprecedented. And so I think that we can be confident in the scientific safety data that have been reported and continue to be monitored to date.
Great. Thank you for that, Dr. Heyer. And again, I think what the caller was describing is more misinformation that is kind of floating out there and is causing people concern unnecessarily, and that to the extent that becomes a impediment to people getting vaccinated, obviously is a problem. So I'm glad you're able to provide that information this evening. Again, *3 on your phone keypad to be connected live with us tonight and to ask a question of our panel. Next, we have Catherine from Pipersville. Catherine, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hello. I'm one of those people that worries about adverse side effects. And recently, you know, there's been that mandate with employment places are now mandating that you get the vaccine. I've heard of many side effects that are serious, including like myocarditis, neurological effects, hearing loss, menstrual changes, and death in some cases. I'm trying to understand what I would be eligible for and try to understand what might be misinformation in terms of the Pfizer vaccine that was FDA approved, which I believe falls under the name Comirnaty. Apologize if I'm saying that wrong, but how does that differ from the Pfizer vaccine that's currently being administered, if it differs at all? And if it does differ, does it change the fact that it falls under the emergency use authorization? And if it still falls under that, how does that affect your possible help along the way if there are adverse side effects?
Dr. Cohen, can you answer that question?
Yeah, sure. So the third, that additional dose of Pfizer that has been recommended is the same. It is not any different. It is the same exact dose as the first two. It's the same shot. And for those who are 18 and over, it is fully approved. It's not under emergency use authorization. The use of that vaccine is fully approved for those 18 and over. Just to reiterate what the senator was saying, I think there is a lot of misinformation and confusion about what the side effects are. Most of the side effects are side effects that you see typically with other vaccines as well, and they're self-limiting, things like aches and fevers and not feeling well and just generally feeling crummy for a few days. There have been some more serious concerns with a couple of the vaccines, and I know myocarditis is one of them, but it is still incredibly rare. The other ones that you mentioned about neurological conditions and changes in menstrual cycles, the data on those are, I should say there's little data on those, and we're not sure how much of it is anecdotal and how much of it is just sort of coincidental. There's just not enough data to say. I will say that, remember that across the world, 6.5 billion doses of these vaccines have been given out, and were these serious side effects issues, major issues, or even, regular issues, we would be seeing a lot more of it. I have read a couple of case studies, individual case studies on menstrual changes, but reading one or two case studies when you have 6.5 billion doses given out, to me, that's not enough data to say that there's any kind of correlation, and that probably it's at this point, the only thing we could say is that it might just have been coincidental. It's really hard to say. I will say that with 6.5 billion doses given out, these are now the most studied vaccines ever given in the history of the world. And I absolutely understand the concerns. But if you go onto the CDC website, you can look at the adverse reporting system and you can actually see what percentage of people have reported things like fevers and more serious adverse effects. And that might actually help you feel better, because you can see, we are very good in the U.S. about reporting adverse events after vaccines. It's a very robust database, and it might help you feel better to look at those numbers and see how rare those serious side effects are.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. Cohen. And the only other thing I will add is that there's another significant number in all this, and that is the nearly 700,000 people in the United States who have sadly died from COVID-19. So I think that, again, what you're hearing tonight, what you've heard from public health experts across the United States over the last many months now, is that if you are eligible, you need to get vaccinated. Any one of these three vaccines will provide you with protection against COVID-19, and especially protection against severe illness and the possibility of death. Again, to be connected tonight, you need to press *3 on your phone keypad, and you'll be able to ask a question live of our panel. Next, we have David from Levittown. David, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Both my wife and I are in our 70s. We're fully vaccinated with the Moderna shots, and we were wondering if you can mix and get a booster with the Pfizer, if that would work.
Okay, thank you very much for that, David. Great question.
Yes.
Dr. Hyrick, can you take a crack at that?
I'd be happy to. David, the CDC has not recommended that yet. I know that they're working on that right now. So I'm hoping that an answer will be available soon. So I can appreciate your concern and question, and but I can't speak for the CDC. I know that they that these data are being reviewed right now, being analyzed, and the recommendations will be forthcoming.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Again, *3 on your phone to ask a question live tonight of our panel. Next, we have Patty in Newtown. Patty, you are on the line.
Thank you. My question is, what is the opinion of the panel regarding physicians who are refusing to treat patients who are not vaccinated?
Okay. physicians who are refusing to treat patients who are not vaccinated. Dr. Heyer, do you want to offer an answer to that?
That's a really good question. I am a physician, so I will step out of my role as representative of Moderna. You know, you do take a Hippocratic oath, right? When you get your medical license, that does have certain responsibilities that come with the status and the licensure of being a practitioner. And that does include taking care of individuals. And so this, to me, borders on the edge of the Hippocratic Oath. I can appreciate the other side of the story that maybe physicians who have their own medical conditions or themselves are at high risk of COVID-19 for some other reason may have different opinions, and that may be just appropriate infection control practice. So there's probably at least two sides to this story. But I do think there's a Hippocratic Oath obligation under part of this. The sort of status you enjoy as a physician comes with certain responsibilities.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I think we should ask Jim Brexler to offer his perspective on that as a representative of one of the larger healthcare providers in our community. Jim?
Sure. Thank you, Senator. And I'll tell you what, that is a completely unacceptable position. I'm not aware of any physicians in our network or even any that I'm aware of that take that position. In fact, what we do as healthcare providers is we in the offices and in the hospital, we have to take care of infectious disease all the time, and therefore we protect ourselves as if you were infectious. That sometimes scares our patients because we're masked and do some things to be precautionary, but we do not refuse care. I think what was just stated is exactly right. This is what you do as a physician or as a healthcare provider. We're here to take care of you. We are not judgmental about other decisions you may be making.
Thank you very much for that, Jim. I appreciate that. Again, star 3 to connect live to our panel this evening to ask a question. Next, we have Manny in Yardley. Manny, you're live on the line with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator, for this call. This is highly informational. Thanks for the panel of doctors. I have two questions to ask. One is, I am vaccinated. My question here is that even if I am vaccinated, will I be an asymptomatic carrier without even knowing that I have contracted COVID, during the period, right? Is there any precautions or any advice from the community or the doctor community that we have to follow to make sure that, we are, unknowingly spreading this, right? That's my first question. And the second question is, so because of this Delta variant and everything, we see the turnaround time of the COVID testing as immensely increased, right? So even after 5 business days, we are not getting the results. So is there any measures or any actions that we are taking to bring that down so that people can get the results sooner to get to know what they have to do as well?
Great questions. Dr. Heyer, I'm going to start with you on the first question, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Thank you, Senator. So in terms of the question is really, we know there are asymptomatic infections that with the virus that causes COVID-19. That's really why this virus has been able to spread so quickly and so fast. And the Delta variant, which is 97-98% of infections in the United States for some time now, has an enhanced propensity to spread. That being said, we do know that fully vaccinated individuals are much less likely to spread infection than unvaccinated individuals. Now, could I say that specifically you in your situation right now will not spread an asymptomatic infection? Of course, we don't know the answer to that. We just know it's extremely less likely. This is why in many jurisdictions and even nationally, we still recommend that masks be worn, even with vaccinated individuals, to further reduce this likelihood when we have this highly transmissible variant called Delta. Now, if you look at the data across the country with Delta, you'll notice that the new cases or the incidence of Delta is going down. So this would suggest, and we know the vaccination rates are going up, they're not high enough yet, but they're going up. This would suggest that the efforts that we're taking are effective, and this would suggest that vaccinated people are indeed much less likely to carry asymptomatic infections.
That's a great point. Thank you. And I'm going to turn to Dr. Block, who we haven't heard from this evening, if he could speak to this issue of how quickly test results can be turned around.
Well, thank you, Senator, and thank you for the question. And this has been a really very good discussion tonight. I've enjoyed it. The tests that are out there vary in the turnaround time. I mean, all of them can be turned around mechanically in a matter of hours. It's really mostly a matter of the practicality of it and the demand. And really, the only way to decrease turnaround time is to increase the resources. So some places are very good, and you can get very rapid results, and some of the tests are within 15 to 20 minutes in terms of the results. Those and that even includes some of the DNA-based tests, but it's really just a function of the handling of it and the processing and the demand.
Great. Thank you for that, Dr. Block. Again, star 3 to ask a question live of our panel this evening, and we have about 10 minutes left in our town hall tonight. So if you have a question, please press star 3 on your phone. Next, we have Jeff in Newtown. Jeff, you're live on the line with us this evening. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking the time to take my question. So actually, my initial question was already addressed by the panel and had to do with severe adverse reactions from the vaccine. So I think they've commented on that. So perhaps I'll just ask another question for the panel. Is it true that that if you've had COVID, that you have natural immunity against the virus, and that natural immunity would be better than the protection you would get from the vaccine?
Great, great question, Jeff. Thanks. Dr. Heyer, do you want to answer that question?
Sure. I'll be happy to answer. Yes, so indeed, if you are naturally exposed to COVID-19, you will develop a natural immune response that would give you protection from subsequent exposures to the virus. Now, that natural immunity is a little harder to quantify than the immunity that's induced with the vaccines, because the vaccines are very specific. There's no randomized study to look at the performance of natural versus vaccine. I think it would be a study almost impossible to do. We do know in smaller studies that are more limited in scope that people who have had COVID-19 who get vaccinated do have a higher immune response, a more potent immune response, so suggesting that the vaccine is boosting the natural immunity in those cases. So this would give credence to the whole idea that you can have a lasting natural immunity would induce protection. I don't know how long it will last. There's very limited data about this in populations that are very difficult to study because of so many other factors that we can't control. We do know that in our clinical studies, in these where we were able to control many factors, we did immunize people who had been exposed. And the difference in protection, is virtually the same as those who had not been exposed previously. So we know, and the safety profile, the reactogenicity profile was virtually the same. So we know that we can immunize people who've been exposed before with the vaccine, so we don't need to test them before we vaccinate them. That's an important thing.
Great. Thank you for that. Again, star 3 to be connected tonight to ask a question of our panel. Next, we have Julie from Doylestown. Julie, you're live on the line with us tonight. Go ahead.
Hi there, Senator. Thank you so much, and thank you, panel, for taking your evening with all of us. This question really dovetails into Jeff's last question. I know the CDC has 3 requirements for allowing people into the country from airplanes, negative tests within so many days, vaccination, and also documented evidence of recovery. And my first question is, why are we not using documented evidence of recovery for employers, or obviously that's a private matter, but you know, the government and other jobs? And I think part of it was that we don't know how long that immunity lasts, but I know in Europe that immunity is good for 6 months, and then you can, I guess, you get tested or you could get vaccinated at that point. And I just feel like we're using vaccine doses on people who might not need them, and then we could be sending more to people who don't have any immunity at all. So that's my first question. And then my second question is, I just heard about a test from ArcPoint Labs in Doylestown called the neutralizing antibody test, where it rates your immunity 0 through 100, but I don't know much about that test, and I just wondered if you could speak to that. Maybe people could get a test before they get their second or third shots or a booster, and you know, save the vaccine for those who really need it. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Julie. I'm going to ask Dr. Cohen to try to answer your first question, and then Dr. Block the second question. Dr. Cohen?
Sure. Thanks very much. Yeah, that's a good...
Oh, Dr. Cohen, are you still with us?
Yes. Can you not hear me?
You just cut out just for a moment there. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. I think part of the issue is that when a person recovers from a natural COVID-19 infection, we don't know how robust their protection is from another infection. And so, you know, again, a person who was asymptomatic or did not have serious case of COVID-19 may actually have less immunity against being reinfected. And as you said, we don't know how long it lasts. And so data show that, you know, it's about 90 days out. And really what we know from the data are that the immunity you get from the vaccine is robust and long lasting. And that's why in the U.S., for things like employment, they're using vaccination, because it's a simplified, easier way of knowing that a person is protected, as opposed to, you know, it's really complicated to know when a person was last infected, and really we don't know what level of protection they have and how long that's going to last. And so it would make it very complicated to add that, I think, to any kind of employment. As a person who deals with this, I work on what the employment policies are for our own campus. I can't even imagine how that would work. So the vaccine requirement is the safest way and the easiest way of knowing that we're protecting the people on our campus.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. And Dr. Block, can you take a crack at that second part of that question about that particular test that the caller identified?
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for the question. So very briefly, there, of course, you can get tests that will tell you whether or not you've been infected. And one of those tests is done by a company at the biotech center called Plometric. But the question was about neutralizing antibody tests. Now, the thinking is, obviously, when if you have antibodies that neutralize, that means they attack the virus and prevent the virus from infecting. And, of course, it's very reasonable to think that if you have a certain level of antibodies in you that can neutralize the virus, you would be protected. But I want to caution that is correlated. It's never been really proved that there's a certain amount of antibody, neutralizing antibody, that equals protection. That's assumed, and it's very logical, and we're working on that. But that's the one hazard about relying on that too much. We know that protection against a virus infection, particularly a coronavirus infection like the one that is COVID, relies on not just antibodies, but also on what's called a cellular immune response. And the beautiful thing about the vaccines is that all these vaccines induce a very, very strong cellular response as well as an antibody response. And then I'm going to quickly go out on a limb here, because this isn't a little controversial, because Dr. Heyer
Candy's got to be a lot more conservative. He's much more responsible than me. But recovery from a COVID infection, you would think would be really excellent and give you great immunity and protection. And I'll bet it mostly does. But there's evidence that it's actually not as good as the vaccine. And there may be, this is just a whisper campaign in the field. I'm a virologist, that it could be the reason some people get COVID, or the more consequential clinical COVID, is that they didn't launch all that great a protective and an immune response. It's hoped that the vaccine zooms in on generating antibodies, cell response to the spike protein, which would confer protection. That's one of the arguments for getting the vaccine. Now, obviously, there's not conclusive evidence for that. That's my hypothesis.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Block, for that. And we have just a few minutes left, but we have Susan from Washington Crossing. So, Susan, if you're on the line, please go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you, Senator, for taking my call.
Sure.
I received my second Pfizer shot on April 1st. So I do intend on getting a booster. And obviously I do intend also of getting a flu shot. You've commented already that the flu shot and the Pfizer shot can be taken simultaneously. But as a person who's 66 years old, I'm also due for the second pneumonia shot after October 9th. And I do intend on getting the first of the two shingle shots. Can you speak to the order of getting all four of these shots in terms of a waiting period? The Pfizer shot, booster, the flu shot, a pneumonia shot, and a shingle shot.
Sure. Dr. Heyer, do you want to try to answer that in the few minutes we have remaining?
Sure. I mean, the good news is, there. I don't have data to suggest a specific order or timing or intervals or any of that nature. The CDC generally recommends every vaccination opportunity should be taken. So that's what they tell us, and I think then the exact timing and order would be between you and your doctor. Because I don't have a data I can speak from.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And again, I want to thank our panel for taking the time this evening to have this very important discussion and really some excellent information for our residents on these very important issues and obviously of great concern to everyone right now, given where we are with the pandemic. I want to remind everyone on the line that if you did not get a chance to pose your question this evening, you can stay on the line when we conclude the call and leave your question behind, and we will work to get answers to those and respond to you. So please do not hang up. You can stay on the line, leave your question, and we will then get responses to you in the next couple of days. But again, I want to thank all of our four panelists this evening. Really an excellent discussion tonight on this topic, and I really appreciate and very grateful for you taking the time to be with us tonight. Okay,
thank you very much,
welcome.
Senator. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for doing it. Thank you, Senator. And we'll be available to answer questions later if there are more that come in on the line.
Great. Thanks. And thank you all for what you do to help us through this very difficult time. All right. Well, that wraps up our telephone town hall for this evening. I hope you've found it helpful. And again, stay on the line if you have further questions, and we will get those answers to you in the next few days. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.